This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On the Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I'm David Remnick.
And I'm Rhonda Sherman.
Rhonda, tell us why you picked George Saunders and Jonathan Safran Foer to do this. You could have gotten, I guess, any number of novelists or short story writers in dialogue.
Well, they're friends, for starters, and that means they've already got a dialogue going on between them. And also, I thought it might be great to hear what they're working on since they're both just about to finish new novels.
George is working on his first novel, yeah, even though he's in his 50s, so there's a lot to talk about. So here's George Saunders and Jonathan Safran Foer, with Jonathan starting us off.
So I wanted to begin by asking you something very, very basic. And it comes from something you say in your acknowledgments in this book. You say, Caitlin and Elena, yeah, watching you all these years has taught me that goodness is not only possible, it's our natural state. Yeah. So I thought, God, I don't know any other writer who would say that goodness is our natural state, besides Anne Frank.
Yeah. And
I started thinking about goodness and how it feels like your work is constantly engaged with goodness. Mm. And yet I don't really know what goodness is. It's not really morality.
Right.
It's not really kindness. And I was hoping you could talk a little bit about that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, sure. Yikes. Here's the thing. I never really could write very well until we had our kids. And then suddenly it was like the universe got saturated with kind of moral ethical stuff that I felt like I could actually use. And then the experience of watching them made me think they really were naturally good. And then about that same time, we became Buddhists. And one of the things in the Buddhist teachings is that, especially in the Tibetan one, is that there is this thing called Buddha nature. Everybody's got it. You can't earn it or get rid of it. And then what actually happens in our life is that these obscurations get laid in on top of it, partly by the thoughts that we're always having and the habits we acquire. So that, just because it was exciting to me and it fit with what I was seeing with the kids, you know, that actually, if you start from the assumption that people are all the same, they're just these little drops of nectar put in these decaying containers, you know, then it, I mean,
it's
I like
very
it.
Very strange description of.
Yeah, yeah. Or maybe that's just me. I
hope
don't
you
know.
Don't just talk about it with your wife that way.
No, but you know, this idea that you're if you, you know, any moral view we have is basically a scale model to help us do stuff, you know. So for me to say, what if everybody's basically that luminous thing in a container that sometimes works at cross purposes, that gives me a place to start, you know. Whereas the way I thought when I was younger, which is everybody's up. Except me, you know. And then I felt that I couldn't get any traction, you know. And it took me back to the early Catholic stuff, where that was kind of what the nuns were saying in between whacks, you know, was that, yeah. But I mean, for you know, because I actually would say, when I read your work, one of the things that always intrigued me about it and made me love it was that there is this questing quality, and I think that person believes in goodness. So my big question that I wanted to start off with was basically, why do we do art? And second question is that a question that's actually meaningful to you? I think you sort of have to say yes. But
yeah, it does a lot. Yeah. It's a sweet drop of nectar in my desiccated ovaries. I once heard somebody asked if he believed in God, and he said, I'm not only agnostic about the answer, I'm agnostic about the question. Mm-hmm. Like, if it could even mean anything,
right,
because it's so definitional.
When I think about why I sit down in the morning, there's a bunch of unholy or kind of crass reasons. But the one that really is continuing to feed me as I get older is that in the moment of engagement with a text, you don't really, you sort of have to step away from your ideas about it, at least that when I do it. And when you can do that, when you can just respond to your text with the red pen and through many iterations, to see that thing get better than I am is really rich. I see a better part of myself starting to come through. And that's really, for me, has been really addictive, you know. And when I think about why art, that's actually, apart from the crass thing, that's the one that I'm getting sort of more addicted to as I get older, as opposed to
less. Me too. I completely agree.
Yeah.
When I started writing, I was committed to a desire to be known or understood or to have some sort of communion with an imaginary other or a real other or just with myself. And that's fallen away, I think, and been replaced more by a commitment to this accident that you're talking about.
Yeah. In that thing you're calling the accident, how do you actually go about it? Is it iteration? Is it heavy revising? Is it some moment of insight? Or what's, you know?
I had some flies enter my house not that long ago.
So that's it.
Oh. Yeah. and they write my books.
Yeah.
No. And they apparently reproduced, and now there's like lots of flies. I don't know what to do. And I went to the hardware store, and the guy sold me just this like sticky paper, basically, strips of paper. And I was like, what's this? He's like, just put them up. And I said, do they smell good? Like, are the flies going to want to them? Like, what is good about this paper? And he said, they fly around enough that eventually they'll hit that paper.
Yeah.
And sure enough, they are covered with flies. So writing is like the sticky paper. You know, like, I face the page, the blank page. I don't really approach it with too many notions, but a kind of openness to where things might go. So you have to start somewhere. Nobody starts from nowhere. So you have to make some very basic decisions, even if they feel arbitrary. But then from that, the accidents start to happen and the kind of uncontrolled growth. But it's also different at different stages in writing a book. I'm getting to the end of something, and I can't. The accidents are much, much harder to come by. And that kind of willful ignorance is disingenuous.
Right.
Like, I know what I'm doing. I know what I want.
Yeah, you threw the bowling pins up, and you can't pretend that you didn't.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But at this stage of your life and your career, what is there stuff that scares you in writing? Stuff that you kind of go towards because it's scary or lean away from because it is? Or?
I think just trying itself scares me. You know, I said to a friend the other day, we were talking about where I was with my book. I said, look, it's not as good as it could be, but I think it's the best that I can do right now. And she said, that is as good as it could be. Like, what else would it be? Somebody else writing it, like, a little better than you did?
Or,
like,
yeah, yeah.
Or you living a parallel life that was different? Right. Like, this is as good as it can be, as good as you can make it right now. I think that I'm not afraid of artistic choices at all. I'm afraid of saying this is the best I can do. And so there are a couple of responses to that. One is not to show anybody, and the other is not to try.
Ever, yeah.
And I often just don't try. But it catches up to you.
Yeah.
And so that's sort of, I think, been what I've been facing down in the last year or so. How about you?
Well, it's funny because I'm finishing up a book, which is a novel, which is, for me, that's new territory. And what I'm noticing is that exactly that. Like, it's, I don't know when or how to stop, actually, you know. I think, well, I just keep doing this the rest of my life and, you know, keep tinkering with it. So that's scary. And then the other thing I found as I'm getting older is I took a while to publish. My first book didn't come out until I was 38, which 37 or something. So when I finally was able to, I felt like, oh, my God, the grail. You know, I finally figured out what I do and what I don't do. Note to self, keep doing that, you know. And then at some point that wears out because whatever it was that got you in the door in the first place has to grow and evolve. So what I'm finding now is just that I think my work is generally moving towards something that I would say lets in more light, lets in more of the positive valences that I've experienced. But that's a little scary, you know, to sort of give up whatever approach got you to the party is a little bit scary. But otherwise, you're like the shark, you know, you go to the bottom of the tank. So
I find that description really strange, that you say you let in more light. And I've read before that, you know, you feel like your work is inclined toward a kind of cruelness. That, and when I read that, I didn't get it at all. Mm. It's just so absolutely not how I feel. Mm-hmm. I feel much closer to something else that you said, which was that you're engaged with this act of kind of redeeming the holiness of daily activities. The example you gave was a dog licking its asshole, actually. But
I always do that one.
So those are two extremely different models. You could say it's through cruelty that you redeem things.
Yeah.
But it's actually hard for me to imagine what you even mean when you say letting a light in that wasn't there before.
Yeah, I had it. You know Michael Silverblatt, right? You interviewed mm-hmm. him. He's a great interviewer. And he always, we have good interviews, but he always nails me in the hallway. Like, he'll get me, like, teary or something. But one time he said to me, he said, I notice a lot of young writers are sort of imitating you, but what they lack is cruelty. I'm like, Michael? I'm not. And he said, I think actually the power of your work is proportional to the cruelty that you show towards your characters. And I, in the midst of denying it, some kind of tears came up, like, oh shit, that must be true, you know. So there's something about that, and I can't really articulate it. But my point is just that it's kind of thrilling to get to this stage of life and say, oh yeah, the finish line is not yet, and what's frightening to you is probably a pretty decent direction to go in, you know. So that's why I'm becoming a ballet dancer. I wanted to announce that here at the festival. It should be here. I wanted to ask you something, because I hadn't read Eating Animals before the last couple of weeks, and I just loved that book so much. And one of the things I loved about it was the tone, which to me, the word I kept thinking of was courteous. Like, it's a really hot-button topic. And yet, throughout that book, you're doing this beautiful kind of running around to the other side of the table, anticipating the reader's questions, coming back around. And I found it so convincing in the subject matter, but also as kind of a model for why rhetoric is good, you know. So I was wondering if you could talk about how you settled on that tone or stumbled on it, whether it was something you did through craft or maybe your previous life had trained you in it. Or
so, you know, when I write fiction, I know that I want to move somebody. I just don't know how, you know, like in what direction, with what kind of experience. I just know that I want to create something that is transporting. With Eating Animals, I knew how I wanted to move people. You know, there was, I had an old teacher in college, sculptor, and his definition of art is it's the thing that is perfectly useless. And when something begins to take on a use, it can't be art anymore because it's going to be compromising. It can never be made for its own sake. Art is the only thing in the world that's made for its own sake. So Eating Animals was definitely not a work of art because it had a real use, a utility that I intended, which is not to make people vegetarians, although it makes me happy when somebody says, that book made me a vegetarian. The function was really to expand a conversation that feels repressed. Like, if I said to you, you should really drink a different kind of bottled water, you might think I was a little annoying, a little obnoxious, a little presumptuous, but you wouldn't freak out, probably. But when you say to somebody, you should think about eating less meat, a lot of people freak out. And I think, you know, part of that might be because there's a culture of kind of aggressive vegetarians or annoying vegetarians. But I think a more powerful explanation is that everybody agrees that it matters.
Yeah.
It just matters a lot. Life and death matter. And choosing death, or in the case of factory farming, which is to say really all meat in America, choosing cruelty, choosing environmental destruction for culinary pleasure, it's an awkward thing. It's a difficult thing to approach. And you know, you said I would move back and forth across the table. It's because I move back and forth across the table. I don't think these things are simple.
Yeah. Do you have a sense of your political relation to the larger country at this point in your life? How do you like America? That's my question. Let me see. Yes. Do you like America? Yeah. Yeah. And if so, why?
I think I could really say I'm agnostic about the answer and agnostic about the question. You know, what America? Like, small town America, urban America, political America, cultural America. There are a lot of different Americas. And to say I like this or I don't like that it doesn't make any sense.
No. See, that's what middle age is. It does make sense to me.
There are certainly moments. You know, I took my kids to this just corny, like, low-budget amusement park in Connecticut not that long ago. And we were standing in line for one of these trampoline things where they hook you up to a harness. And in front of us was, like, somebody wearing a turban, somebody wearing a kippah, a black person, a white family. And I said to them, you know, there's nowhere else on earth where you would be standing in a line like this and be happy to, and everybody's watching the person in front and cheering for them. So that's an oversimplification of America. But I don't think that, you know, despite the endemic problems, I still think no one has succeeded as well as we have in creating situations like that.
Yeah, yeah.
Thank you very much.
Novelist Jonathan Safran Foer, talking with George Saunders, author of some of the best short stories of our time, from the 2015 New Yorker Festival.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.